It's a Thursday edition of Locked On Heat. On today's show, we are joined by Rohan Nadkarni from Sports Illustrated, the crossover, to talk about Dwayne Wade's impact on the Heat so far and his future with the team.
And we'll talk about the importance of the Heat making the postseason before getting to some Eastern Conference playoff predictions. Let's get to the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm a credentialed writer covering the NBA for the Step Back and FanRag Sports. And I write for the Miami Heat's Tip-Off magazine. You can find me on Twitter at WC Goldberg.
And I'm David Ramil, a credentialed NBA writer who's covered the Heat for SB Nation and allyoucanheat.com. I cover the league at large for FanSided and FanRag Sports. And you can follow me and my writing on Twitter at DRamil13.
According to a recent article published by the Miami Herald's Barry Jackson, Dwayne Wade is undecided on whether or not he will return next season. I mean, we're not even done with this season, but of course, Dwayne Wade being 36 years old, we're wondering, okay, how many more years in Miami does he have left? Rohan, we haven't had you on since the trade that brought back Dwayne Wade to South Beach. So let's start there. Your reaction to when Wade returned, and your impressions of his impact so far before we move on from there.
I just got a question before we start. Do you have to be a credentialed writer to be on this podcast?
It helps.
Okay, because we're going to have to talk about my status perhaps after the show.
You were more credentialed than I was in LA, so...
Yeah,
you'd be surprised, Wes.
Did you sneak into Shaquille O'Neal's trailer or something like that? Is that how you were able to hobnob with him during All Star Week?
I snuck into a lot of things, man. but let's talk about Dwayne. When I found out, I was at the office. I was at the Sports Illustrated office, and you know, it was crazy because I saw a tweet that Stephen A. Smith had maybe mentioned it on his radio show. So it was kind of unclear if he was reporting it or it was just kind of speculation. Then all of a sudden, you see the Woj tweet. Come across. It was crazy. I mean, obviously, I was happy. I think we all wanted him back in Miami for a long time. My impressions so far are, you know, I'm certainly happy he's back on the team. I like that Spo is kind of letting him run the second unit a little bit. I'm already a little, I guess, curious is the word, is how much Spo is going to rely on him at the end of games. I'm actually planning on writing about this week about kind of how the Heat should use him. But I think when it comes to Dwayne right now, less is going to be more for the Heat.
Yeah.
You know, they still have guys that they need to develop, whether it's Justice. Something that I thought was interesting in that game against the game winner, I can't believe it, against the 76ers. Yes. You know, they used the Kelly Bam front court with Jay Rich, Wade. You know, that's usually Justice's lineup. He took, you know, Wade took his place in that lineup. That lineup was playing incredible until, you know, Kelly and Wayne kind of got hurt. So, you know, I'm interested to see how that works moving forward. Is Justice going to get marginalized? So I'm very excited he's back on the team. I think he does give them, you know, a little bit more in the pick and roll, which they really need, frankly. But I am a little curious to see if Spo is going to rely on him this much at the end of games.
Yeah, I think it's curious that even after a 27-point explosion that nobody expected at this point in his career, that I think we're all in agreement that having him control the offense late in the fourth quarter in clutch situations as he's had to do on a number of occasions in just six games since his return is a little disconcerting. Like, he shouldn't be having that kind of control at this point in his career, not with everybody else on the team. And you know, again, your good point about you know, younger players needing to develop there, that's an issue as well. So,
you know, I'll just play devil's advocate, even though I think I agree mostly with what you guys are saying, but, you know, we did approach this trade deadline wondering what kind of moves the Heat would make and saying, you know, and right before the trade deadline, Miami's success in crunch time situations had started to crater.
Yeah.
And because they had so much success earlier in the season, they didn't really have a guy that they could go to late. We wanted sort of Goran Dragic to be that person for the Heat. That's not really his game. It's not really ever been his style. Josh Richardson had to sort of take that mantle in December mostly. And he had some success doing it, but there was no consistent player that the Heat could sort of just throw the ball to and figure out. I mean, there were moments where they'd give the ball to James Johnson. He wouldn't even get a shot off before the final buzzer went off. So the Heat needed somebody like Dwayne Wade. Now, are they relying on him a little bit too much since Wade's come back? Yeah, I wonder how much of that is to do with the emotions, how much of that is just to do with just this team sort of being deferential in nature and just sort of giving it to a guy like Dwayne Wade, who's never been that sort of, who has always been that the kind of guy who is willing and able to take the final shot. Not only able, but willing is a key part of that. And I don't know if anybody else on this roster, now that, especially since Deion Waiters has been injured for most of the season, is that sort of player. So, you know, it's kind of like, all right, we want that kind of guy at the trade deadline. Then Miami gets that person to the best of their ability, you know, to somebody willing to take that shot. And now we're all like, well, hold on, wait, like what happened to that ball movement though?
Yeah, I will say he was getting some pretty good looks last night in the fourth. I mean, that last shot he took was probably not the shot we wanted in that situation, ironically enough. But, you know, when he was had the ball at the top of the key, he does still have a certain respect on pick and rolls that no one else on the roster really has. I mean, you see him kind of get that space, you know, at the top half of the paint where he can pull up or take a floater. You know, when Hassan seems to give his screens a little more juice when he's setting them for Dwayne, and, you know, that helps him as a roller. So I will say, ironically, aside from the last shot, he was doing a good job of getting the team good looks down the stretch.
So let's go back to that Barry Jackson point, because I know, Rowan, you've talked to Wade a number of times. You've been invited to Gabriel Union's latest screenings and things of that sort. So you're as plugged in as anybody. What are your thoughts on whether or not he'll return this year? Like the fact that the story breaks from Barry just hours before he has his best game of the season is kind of, you know, it's interesting, you know, whether or not he's trying to prove that he still has it or something like that. You never know with somebody like Dwayne. But what are your thoughts? Do you think he comes back for one more go around?
I always thought he would play three more seasons when he signed his 2-year deal with Chicago. I think in his head, he might have looked at it as like, I'm going to play these two seasons in Chicago and then I'll have kind of that final run in Miami.
Right.
Now I wonder if him being here now maybe pushes him closer to retirement. But if I had to guess, and this is maybe my emotions playing into it a little bit as well, if I had to guess, I know he says he doesn't want the quote-unquote Kobe tour, but I would not be surprised if he came back for one last season and then maybe didn't announce it necessarily before, but, you know, made it kind of obvious that this was his last go around. I think, you know, if the Heat are willing to pay him and he doesn't have to play a big role, he can kind of have that last year where, you know, he kind of finally gets to relax a bit, so to speak. I mean, you look at the last couple years he had, I mean, he's expected to be kind of the quote-unquote third alpha in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Then this year with Cleveland, I mean, there was always high expectations on that team. I almost wonder if he'd like to come back. Obviously, it's a grind, but a year kind of with no drama.
It does sort of feel like he would want to come back for a year, sort of coming back to Miami midseason, being able to sort of settle in that way and then have the summer to really get back into shape, I suppose, and then come back for one last kind of hurrah. But the interesting part about this, and it's sort of the elephant in the room I don't feel like anybody's really talking about, is Dwayne Wade is at this point in his career where he doesn't necessarily want to win another title. Like maybe he tried to do that in Cleveland and what signing in Cleveland this past summer, but I think he's come to terms right now that his legacy is pretty much like set in stone. And that same Barry Jackson piece, he was asked about, you know, getting the number one spot in blocks for a guard of all time, right? And taking that spot away from Michael Jordan. He said that would be kind of cool. And that was sort of like his reaction was like, that would be neat, but it's not like something I deeply care about and am passionate to get. And you kind of juxtapose that sort of him being in the twilight and the final run of his career with where this Heat team is, a bunch of young guys trying to still prove that they're even worth their contracts, still trying to get into the postseason and build really in a lot of ways since the big three in that post big three era. And it's just, it doesn't quite like the motivation of Dwayne Wade and the motivation for the rest of this group and even the front office. I'm not sure it quite lines up even for a guy like Pat Riley, who may want to get one more whale and one more championship run out of this organization before he sails off into the sunset. You know, like that's not really what Wade's motivation is at this point. So I wonder, again, in that Jackson piece, Wade said he would sit down with Pat Riley and Mickey Arison and everybody that's involved there and kind of figure out where they want to go next. I'm wondering, and I'm just throwing this out there, I'm just pure reckless speculation. If and when that sit down does happen, does Pat Riley say, hey man, like either you're here to go 100% into this playoff into a playoff race and to try to win a title this year, or you should probably just retire.
But hasn't Riley kind of massaged those expectations? Like, I don't think that he sees this team as it's currently comprised and sees a legitimate title contender. Do you?
Sure. No, but like if the goal eventually is to sort of develop these guys, package them together, and try to move for an all-star, which has to be the goal because I don't see any other way to get that sort of player, then it doesn't having Dwayne Wade on the roster sort of hinder that development from some of these guys like Justice Winslow, like Rohan talked about earlier, and Tyler Johnson, who sort of plays the same position there. Like, I wonder if what Dwayne Wade wants is just a farewell tour, that doesn't line up with just, again, how this team is sort of moving forward, you know?
It's interesting. I mean, on one hand, it's like, can you really have Goran, Tyler, Josh, Dion, and Wade all on the same team and Justice? I mean, those are really all guys who should be playing guard at this point. So I think it's you have to start from there. That's interesting. I do think it's a salient point to bring up the organization's interest because I think as much as everyone loves Dwayne, they have this gigantic logjam in the backcourt. I do think there is something we said about, you know, the guys really do seem to respond to Dwayne. I think he has a great relationship with Josh, a great relationship with Tyler. I mean, I don't think Justice ever wanted him to leave. So, you know, he might be able to help in a developmental aspect from just being around these guys, you know, showing them the work he still puts in, passing down his knowledge. And in terms of chasing a star, I think, you know, people might not be coming to Miami to play with Dwayne Wade, the star, but it might help to have them and have him there in terms of a recruiter, someone who can still kind of help maintain the locker room culture if you're trying to bring in another big name who's going to maybe kind of take over.
All right. Well, we got to move on to and backtrack really to this season because there's still a playoff run to be had, and Dwayne Wade's going to play a major factor in that. So we'll talk about why it's so important for this Heat team to make the playoffs. But first, a quick reminder to subscribe to Locked On NBA, which will be revamping its format. In addition to hosting Locked On Heat on a daily basis, David and I will be hosting Locked On NBA every Tuesday for the rest of the season. It will be a digestible show, just 20 or 30 minutes long, delivering the most important news, scores, and storylines of the day.
Just as Locked On Heat is your daily briefing on all things Miami Heat related, Locked On NBA is your first stop for the most important headlines and analysis from around the NBA. Make sure to leave us a review in iTunes and please subscribe on your favorite podcasting app.
All right, we're going to talk later about which team would be the best potential matchup for the Heat in the first round of the playoffs, but let's start with just making the postseason in general for the Heat. Look, Miami right now, they're eighth place in the Eastern Conference. They're a game behind the Sixers for seventh place after that win the other night. They're 3.5 games ahead of the Pistons for the eighth place spot. So they've got a firm-ish grasp, I would say, on a playoff position here. But look, given that Miami re-upped last season's 30-11 squad, Rohan, how important is it that the Heat make the playoffs this season?
I think it's definitely important. I mean, we talked about it. They kind of put a lot of faith into this group. They handed out the big contract to Olynyk. I mean, it helps on multiple fronts, right? On one hand, you don't want to have, as an organization, you don't want to have made an investment into all these players, and then all of a sudden it looks like, hey, did we make a huge mistake? Did we know what we were doing? Did we know what we were getting into? I mean, the draft pick situation, I believe the pick is kind of top seven protected. I don't think they're going to be bad enough to jump into the top seven of the draft. So, like, the pick you have to assume is going to Phoenix this year, no matter what. Beyond that, if you are trying to go whale hunting, if you do want to, you know, swing a deal where you package some of your guys for a better player, I don't think that's going to happen, you know, on a roster that didn't make the playoffs. So if you want to trade, you know, let's say it's James Johnson or whoever, it would help a lot to showcase those guys in the playoffs, maybe win a round or play a team tough, you know, to kind of prove that you have a nucleus that's attractive to more players. So I think it's really important on multiple levels that they make the playoffs.
I don't get the same sense of urgency from this team. I agree with all of your points. Like, from a logical perspective, you certainly get that feeling that they have to prove that those investments were you know, on the money. But I just don't get that same kind of urgency that we felt last season. Like, maybe it was because there was no pressure for them to succeed, and all of a sudden they kind of fell ass backwards into that 13-game win streak, and Dion was playing at such a high level. And the playoffs then, all of a sudden, after such a bad start, became a realistic possibility. But the way that they've lost a number of clutch games throughout the whole season, really, I just don't see that this team is as fully invested as they were last year. I'm not sure if it's chemistry issue, whether or not it's The fact that they didn't have that closer for much of the season, I'm not sure what it might be, to be honest with you, but I don't see this team understand how imperative it is for them to make the postseason.
I kind of agree, actually. Just throwing out there real quick. I mean, they have a negative net rating. They haven't been very good, and there's been a lot of stops and starts. So I do kind of agree that it seems like on some level they've just lacked some kind of focus or something.
I'm glad you brought up the point differential there, because I've been sort of beating this drum for quite some time that, you know, even when the Heat were fourth in the East, you know, and were just like, I think, a game out of being in third, that point differential still wasn't even positive. I don't think it was. It certainly wasn't very impressive. It certainly or within like the kind of region that you would expect a fourth seed to be in. This team's not very good, and I think that's quite obvious through 60 games now. You know, it's not a very good team, even if you add Dwayne Wade into the mix here. And for that reason, I think making the playoffs is going to be really important, because it almost tricks the organization into thinking that they're better than they are. And maybe to your point, Rohan, it tricks the rest of the league into thinking that maybe Miami is better than they are. And maybe somebody's willing to take one of these James Johnson or Tyler Johnson or Deion Waiters contracts off their hands. Or, you know, maybe Miami is able to – maybe there's a Chris Paul out there that says, you know what, I want to go there because I feel like I can make a difference. You know, so trade me there. You know, referencing what Chris Paul did with Houston this last summer. So I think in that respect, it's going to be really important, because look, if they don't make the playoffs, it'll be the third time in four seasons that they don't make the postseason. They would more than likely finish with a negative point differential in a weak Eastern Conference. I mean, that's when a lot of questions and stuff are going to start setting in. And next thing you know, the Heat are going to look a lot closer to what the Charlotte Hornets sort of are right now, where they, you know, the Hornets a couple seasons ago banked on re-signing their own guys, they banked on internal development, and it didn't work out. And now Rich Cho is reportedly on the hot seat, you know? So I'm not saying that that's going to happen with Pat Riley or Andy Ellisberg, but it's going to draw some criticism and some questions that just, frankly, this Heat organization can't really deal with. They kind of do have to deliver at least a playoff position here, because that was sort of the whole point of re-signing this whole group. Because if you don't make the playoffs, then I don't know really what the next step is, because you're locked into this team. And so it's going to look pretty dire if that's the circumstance.
Yeah. I also just want to say, I think it will be embarrassing if this team misses the playoffs and a team like Indiana makes it. And that's not to take anything away from what Indiana has done. I mean, Victor Oladipo is having a hell of a season, and they clearly deserve all the success they are having. But you're looking at a team that traded away someone like Paul George, was, I believe, the 7 seed last year, and they're somehow playing better now. I mean, you can't really, I think, afford to have that happen just from an optics perspective around the league. And I will say, I agree that it's not a good team, and there's proof out there.
Oh yeah,
I do think there are elements of a good team in this roster. I think in the middle of the season, you know, Spo almost does a better job when his options are taken away from him. I mean, you remember that win in Boston, the 90-89 win. Olynyk had a huge game. They bust out the zone defense. You know, they were missing so many people in that game. You know, Spo, when he's given restraints, I think almost does a better job. And I think he's kind of struggled lately, now that more players are healthy, to find the right combinations. Again, you know, there was that stretch where the Jay Rich, Ellington, Winslow, Bam, Olynyk lineup was running teams off the floor, but he would hesitate to use it. He wouldn't use it to close games, you know, when he should have. He stuck with the starting lineup that had the JJ Hassan front court for too long, that has not been good. So, you know, I almost think that he has too many pieces to deal with right now, and there are elements of a good team on the roster.
Preseason predictions were kind of all over the map, but would you go so far as to say that this team, even though they weren't expected to be, again, a title contender, has underachieved all season long?
Underachieved is interesting. I mean, if you want to compare it to the end of last season, I would be willing to say underachieved. I mean, we were obviously all excited the way last season ended. You had to expect some level of regression from guys like JJ, obviously Deion as well, who was probably never healthy and probably should have never played this season. But, you know, I'm willing to say underachieved, because there are pieces here for what would be a good roster. And unfortunately, you know, you have a guy like JJ who struggled this year. You know, ill-timed injuries, which you can't really use as an excuse, but I'm willing to say I'm itchy.
It's interesting. Wes, you brought up that Hornets comparison, and I know you were doing it from a front office slash salary cap perspective, but one of the things that they share in common was that that team, especially last season, was really bad in clutch games. Like, didn't they lose like a number of games? Like, weren't they like 0-14 in games decided by 3 points or less or something like that? They just couldn't seem to close the deal, and maybe that's because they lacked a true quote-unquote superstar, but there's something similar in the way Miami has failed to be able to capitalize in those clutch moments this year as well.
Well, recently they have, right? And at the start of the season, they were really good in those situations. And I think off the top of my head, you know, kind of based on what the difference is between wins and losses in those close games and probably where this team's going to finish, they'll still probably come out positive in close games, right? And that's probably just that Heat culture, Eric Spoelstra, coaching magic, you know, fairy dust at work. And there's something to be said about that, right? Even if you have a negative point differential, I still think that there's a difference between just looking at that and then saying, okay, this team still manages to figure out ways to win. And this team was really good on the road to start the year. They've been better at home recently. And look, I feel like we're spinning this negative, but you know, by the time everybody's hearing this, Miami is still coming off of that win against the 76ers. They've won two straight games. They're in the midst of a homestand that's going to be really important going into this Lakers game.
If they're
going
to go on a streak, it's got to be now.
100%. We talked about that, I think, on the show this week, where this is the stretch that's really going to determine whether or not they make the postseason or even what sort of seed that they're going to be when it's all said and done. So look, let's talk about the playoff seeding. We'll predict what the Eastern Conference playoff picture is going to look like next. But before we move on to that final segment, let's go to iTunes and see if we have any new reviews. David, how's it looking?
Well, we're stuck at 90 reviews, unfortunately. Rowan hasn't done his share. we're trying to get more listeners to offer their input there. But you know what? We won't make our self-imposed quota of 100 before the end of February, but we still got some really great reviews, including this one from Flyboy7, who writes, "Just found the podcast. Great to see a daily Heat podcast. I appreciate what you guys bring, a fresh and non-traditional view to the Heat. Keep it up." So thank you so much, Flyboy7.
That's my alt account. I didn't tell you that.
Such a burner?
Yeah, dude.
Was Flyboys 1 through 6 were already taken?
Yeah, they were. Exactly.
Look, he said he just found the podcast. So that's the whole point of these reviews, right? It just helps other people discover the show and increases our ranking within iTunes itself. So make sure that you submit a 5-star review and you can get a shout out on the next episode, just like 5x7 / Rohan, I guess. Playoff predictions. I guess we have to do them. We'll talk about that. We're going to talk about also which of these teams would be, I guess, the most optimal opponent for the Heat to face in the first round. But let's start with some predictions. Rohan, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. You want me to give my guess on what the seeding is going to be, or?
Yeah, let's do that. Do we all? So actually, I was going to ask, do we all think number one is the same? But we might not. So do you want to just list yours off one through four? Let's start with the top four.
All right, my top four. I think the top three is going to hold. I think Toronto will finish one. Toronto's been really good. Toronto's been really good all season. I think they're going to finish one. The Celtics, something looks a little off there. The offense is still not great, so I think they're going to – so that's going to hold. So I got Toronto, Boston, Cleveland, and I think Washington's going to hold on to the four seed. They've found something with Sato. If Wall comes back healthy, I mean, their depth is looking a little bit better now, so I think the top four is going to hold.
You're saying they're better without Wall, right? Clearly, you're saying they're better off without John Wall.
Oh, absolutely. They should trade Wall to Miami for Hassan Whiteside.
You've been beating that drum for a while, though. Let's be honest. That was
I think I agree with that. Toronto, I think, holds. Their point differential is up there with the Warriors and the Rockets, and I think that's going to balance out towards the end of the year, and Toronto will hold on to that one seed. Boston, I think Boston's still number two, but only because they are so far ahead of Cleveland that Cleveland won't catch them. Right. And then, look, Washington has seemed to have – like, that fourth spot has been in flux all season, but it does seem like Washington has the highest time in possession of that fourth seed. So I'm inclined to give it to them as well. I don't know, like, Satoransky, is he just better than John Wall at this point? I mean, I'm being sarcastic, but like, he has been a revelation for them. And, you know, I'm starting to, I don't know how sarcastic you were being, Rohan, about that, but I'm starting to think that the Wizards might also be better without John Wall. I feel like Wall's still probably a better option in the playoffs, but I don't know. There's something about sort of the chemistry that they have right now.
No, I think the big thing is I don't know if he was ever fully healthy. And I think you got to take that into account. I mean, it's the same way. I don't think Deion Waiters was as bad of a player as he was this season, but I just don't think his ankle was ever right. And I think you have to take that into account with Wall. I think he was maybe pushing himself a lot more than he should have. I'm not willing to say they're better without him. I do think that Bradley Beal might be kind of the player who they should run their offense through. He should maybe be the number one option. I'm willing to hear that argument, but I don't think they're a better team.
I think Beal might be their best player.
I think that's fair.
And without Wall, it's sort of unlocked that. So maybe when Wall comes back, you're right. They do start to run that offense through Beal a little bit more. I just don't know how much you can really get away with that with John Wall and still have a happy John Wall. You know what I mean?
I don't see Scott Brooks going in there and saying, you're going to have to take a backseat to Bradley Beal. That's not going to happen.
Maybe a Wall for Waiters swap could work. Hey, they've got history, Scott Brooks and Deion. David, who's your top four?
Yeah, it's the same. I mean, Washington's playing really well now. And to Rowan's point, their depth looks much, much improved. So I'm curious, though. I mean, you know, Wall's departure and the fact that they've played as well as they have kind of speaks volumes about, like, how everybody finds their role in the NBA in the absence of a superstar. It's, you know, without a ball-dominant player, all of a sudden everybody seems more willing to, I don't know, improve, to take an extra step. Like, maybe they feel more tired. Yeah, everybody's eating, but they're eating with a sense of urgency. And maybe that's part of the problem. Like, maybe that's what's missing in Miami, is that everybody's healthy now and everybody doesn't realize that there needs to be a sense of urgency.
So let's go to the next four, Rowan. We got.
I think here is where it may mix up a little bit. Right now, the Pacers are at five. Indy's been playing really well. But I think the Bucks are going to overtake them. I really like what Milwaukee's done since firing Jason Kidd. I think they can figure it out. They lost a heartbreaker to Washington last night. So I think it's going to be Milwaukee. Then I think Philly's going to stay on their hot streak and finish six. Then I got Indy, and I think the Heat are going to finish eighth.
I have the same thing. I've got Milwaukee at five. Jabari Parker, you add him in there. You get rid of the Jason Kidd factor, so that's an improvement automatically. And I like the star power of Giannis, man. Like, I think that stuff matters when you're going into these next 20 games. And if you're Milwaukee, I think you're eyeing Washington at that four spot and saying, we could beat them if we've got this fifth seed. But if we have to face Cleveland, you know, that's tougher. You know, that LeBron-Giannis matchup, I mean, Giannis has done a nice job. But if you're Milwaukee, I think there's a sense of urgency to jump up and grab that fifth seed and have that matchup against Washington in the first round, and then just sort of build on Giannis's playoff experience, which is going to be so important. Indiana, I do think they fall off a little bit. I'm with you. I think Philadelphia keeps moving up. I like what they're doing lately. I think they grab the sixth seed. Indiana falls to the fifth seed. Right now, it's only a game and a half difference between five and seven, so it's extremely possible that this all happens. And Miami, I just think, is too far back right now to really make any major moves. But I think they hang on to that eighth spot.
I disagree. I'm having them leapfrog over Indiana. I think Indiana's makeup, I mean, you know, adding Trevor Booker notwithstanding, I think if they're going to free fall or have any kind of loss, you know, start accumulating any sort of losses, they'll drop below Miami. I have faith that Miami will be able to figure it out, particularly if they win the next few games during this, you know, crucial home stretch. I think that kind of gives them the momentum later on. They're feeling good. They've got the addition of Wade to help kind of, you know, buoy the team a little bit. And so I think Indiana, they've given a valiant effort all season long, but I could see them, falling over the next few games. And you know, because, I mean, I think anything at this point is kind of gravy. They're playing with house money. The fact that they're playing at this level is impressive, but I could see them dropping to the eighth seed. In fact, I could see Philadelphia dropping. Like, I don't have faith in them, not as much as you have, Wes. I know it's something that you and I have talked about a number of times, but I just think that they lack a clear leader there that has the kind of experience and the understanding of what it takes to get into the postseason. J.J. Redick's a fine player, but he's not that guy for that team. And as much as Embiid has played at a high level, I just don't, you know, I think that lack of experience will hurt them in the next few weeks. And I think Miami could possibly leapfrog them all the way to sixth.
So then what do you have? What's your?
I've got Miami finishing seventh, Milwaukee at fifth, Philadelphia probably at 6, Miami at 7th, and Indiana at 8th.
Okay.
But I could see Miami and Philadelphia flipping.
All right. So our predictions notwithstanding then, who would be the best option? So because Miami really is in the mix for anywhere between 6, I would say 6 and 8th. Getting all the way up to 5th is probably a little out of the question at this point. And then, you know, Toronto and Boston, they could flip. If Miami moves up a certain amount, they could end up facing Cleveland or Washington or whatever. But among those top three, Cleveland, Boston, Toronto, who would be the best opponent for – who would be the best matchup for the Heat as far as Miami possibly pulling off an upset in the first round?
I don't know if they're going to upset any of those teams. If I had to pick, I think it's Toronto. Ooh. They've just played them really well all year. They played them well a couple years ago. I think that's probably the best bet there. I think they match up fairly well. I don't think it's Boston. I think Boston is going to be really good in the playoffs because of their defense, and they have a guy like Kyrie who can kind of close for them down the stretch. So, and then you never want to see LeBron in a first round playoff series. So I think Toronto is their best bet for an upset, as unlikely as it is.
Well, to Rowan's point, I was covering today's Raptors Magic game, and some of the Raptors beat guys were talking about the potential matchup with Miami in the playoffs, and they actually expressed concern. So they might be feeling the same way you are, Rowan, as far as, you know, they kind of quoted Miami's toughness and defense and the fact that they kind of make you work so hard for buckets as points in Miami's favor. And there was legitimate concern there, although I think they think that this team is the best Raptors team that they've ever seen. But there is concern there. As far as best matchup, I don't know. I honestly think Boston probably, as good as their defense is, I think their offensive struggles play to Miami's favor. And you can't underestimate the Kelly Olynyk factor. Look, he played so well in that big game you referenced earlier. I think he could have big moments against that team. I kind of like the Miami's ability for like Josh Richardson to kind of limit what Kyrie does best. And who else on that roster is going to step up? Al Horford? I mean, they're going to be without Hayward, Jason Tatum. That's a lot of pressure. Jaylen Brown, completely unproven. So, I mean, if you can limit Kyrie or keep him from exploding, I think you can really clamp down their offense. And then, yeah, their defense is a struggle, but Miami can find a way. Like, they play better in that kind of sluggish mud. So I like their chances against Boston. I could see an upset against the Celtics, not against the Raptors.
I just want to throw out that this is why you guys are credentialed writers, because you hear David with the on-the-ground reporting. In Orlando, I'm assuming, does he cover the Magic now? I don't know, but he's at the game and he's finding out what's happening, and he's got the inside info on how the Toronto beat writers feel. So, you know, I can see what you guys are going for now, and I should probably start going to more basketball.
I feel like I'm being mocked somehow. I'm not sure.
No, you're not. That was great. That was great information. I went to the office today and I ate some lunch, and I just got home and ate some more food.
And we have food to talk about later. We've got it all ready to go. David, just to sort of keep praising David here, if I didn't realize segment three was going to turn into
– It's about time. It's been a long time coming, buddy.
I couldn't have said it better myself. All the reasons you said, I think Boston would be the best thing. Same things you said. Look, I mean, that you would play at a slower pace. Miami, I think, has throughout the season typically – fared better against offenses that are really kind of like a one-man show offense, and they have like the ensemble cast. Those are the kind of the groups that have given them problems. Toronto is what Miami is, but better. You know, Toronto is just – I mean, I know Raptors fans would say, no, DeRozan and Lowry are superstars. I don't think they're quite there. I would still take Kyle Lowry Kyrie Irving over Lowry or DeRozan as far as just give this guy the ball, let him score. So I think just sort of that ensemble group that the Raptors have, the size that they have, especially on the perimeter, would give Miami fits. So I kind of like Miami's ability to sort of go at Boston and just sort of have this Eric Spoelstra, Brad Stevens, you know, coaching matchup, which I think is what that series would ultimately sort of result in, even though Boston does have the one, like probably the two best players in the series between Horford and Kyrie Irving. But I do think that, but you know, Eric Spoelstra could sort of get his team into the mix. And then if as long as they're just in the mix, I think it would be possible. But just to sort of go back to that first thing that we were sort of talking about, I don't think an upset would likely happen in any case. But if it were to happen, I guess is the question here. Boston's probably their best bet. Nobody picked Cleveland, obviously, because that would be crazy, right?
But it would be fun, though.
Oh, hell yeah. Also, I'm sort of rooting for Miami-Boston because I just want – it would be great if Spoelstra was able to beat Brad Stevens, and then I was proven right all along that Brad Stevens is the second best coach in the Eastern Conference.
I don't know if the Heat want those problems, man. Boston's got depth. I think the Celtics are going to play really well in the playoffs. I mean, it's incredible that without Hayward they've been this good.
No, I agree. All right. Well, that wraps it up for basketball talk, but as we do every time Rowan comes on the show, we defer to Rowan for his latest recipes, cookbooks, and just wild ideas that he's having in the kitchen. So I know that we had talked a little bit about beforehand reverse searing, which is just some straight up Cooking Channel stuff. I want you to explain to our listeners what exactly is happening here. Not just a sear, not I don't even like I'm going to clear out right now. It's all you. Go ISO.
Okay, well, first of all, let me say I certainly cannot take credit for this method anyway. I'm sure we've discussed my guru, Kenji Lopez-Alt, who writes for Serious Eats, developed this method when he was working for Cooks Illustrated. Great name for a magazine, if you ask me.
I looked it up because I had no idea what you were talking about, and his name just came up.
There we go. It's a real thing.
Serious. So Cooks Illustrated is a magazine? Like, are like the first several pages just like aerial shots of like kitchens? Like amazing.
Here's the thing about the reverse sear. Now, traditionally, a lot of times when people are cooking a steak or a thick pork chop, they'll sear it in their hot pan and then finish it in the oven. We've all heard of that method. You know, you have a piece of meat, you sear it, you get a good color on it, you put it in the oven, you take it out, it's done, it's great, right? A lot of people have done that before. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Here's the thing about the reverse sear. You know, there's this old mentality among chefs that you sear something into, quote unquote, lock in the juices. Now, science has proven that that's a fake thing. That's not really true.
Science.
You don't have to sear first.
Can't take science seriously.
So when you reverse sear something, basically what you're doing is you're bringing the inside of your meat to temperature, right? So you cook it on a really low heat. Wes, I know you love steaks. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're dealing with like a thick New York strip, right? Ooh. And you're wondering what's the best way to cook this so that the top isn't overcooked, but I have the right temperature gradient in the middle. You want to cook it in an oven first, but on a really low heat. So let's say you have a New York strip. You want to put it in the oven for about 25 to 30 minutes on 250 degrees. Mm. All right. That's like a suggested temperature range and time. If you're using a thermometer, that's really the best way to do this. So you cook the meat on a low heat in an oven for a long period of time, and then you finish it in a pan. That's the reverse sear part. You cook it in the oven first and you sear it after, so you get the crust that you want. And basically the advantage of this method is you get a very even cook throughout the steak. Now, a lot of times when you sear it, you'll get like kind of a gray ring around your medium rare center. This gives you a more even cook throughout the steak, but with that crusty goodness that you're accustomed to.
You bastards have brought up cooking steak twice in a row now, and for a vegetarian, that is truly evil.
You can do the same thing. I'm sure you could do the same thing to an eggplant.
Yeah, it sucks a lot, Wes. Can we discuss like veggie recipes, something? I don't know. Something with couscous, maybe. Help me out here. You're talking about a perfectly cooked medium rare steak, and I'm slowly drooling over my laptop. God damn it.
Well, there's two things here. First of all, David, one of these days I'll send you a recipe for a roasted corn dish that I really like. I think you'll enjoy it. Secondly, I need to issue a public apology to David because he was visiting New York. He asked me for restaurant recommendations, and I just gave him none. I just dropped the ball. I even asked him where he was staying, acted like I was going to give him some recommendations, and didn't. And I've been feeling so much guilt over it.
That's okay. All is forgiven. I appreciate it. You're a busy man. Like I said, you're hobnobbing with LA Elite. You can't be expected to tell me what the best cheap eats in the city are. So no big deal. We may do it regardless, but I did curse your name a couple of times. And you might see some graffiti somewhere around Times Square. But other than that, no worries.
Fortunately, I never hang out in Times Square. So,
well, what was the best thing you ate when you were in LA? I'm just curious.
You know, that's a good question. I went to this lunch spot called Mendocino Farms, and I had a sandwich there that was actually really, really, really good. I went to In-N-Out, and I liked it. I'm not ready to have the In-N-Out conversation in public yet.
Was that your was that your first In-N-Out experience?
It was. It was.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, I really liked Mendocino Farms. I had a great sandwich there.
I was trying to get to Shake Shack, but I didn't make it. There was apparently a Shake Shack in downtown LA that I was planning on going to, and I finally walked there on my last or my second to last day there, and it was under construction. Turns out it's not even open yet. So that kind
of. Have you been to Shake Shack?
I have been to Shake Shack. I've been to the Shake Shack in Miami. It's the only one I've ever been to, but I haven't been in maybe 3 or 4 years, and I was really looking forward to it. So I know there's a bunch of them in New York, right?
Yeah, there is. Oh, yeah. I didn't go to one specifically because my favorite noodle shop up there always closed down and was replaced with a Shake Shack. So now I won't go out of spite.
Oh, my gosh.
I respect that. I really respect that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, we respect you, Rowan, for coming on to the show and sharing your recipes and your Miami Heat hot takes. But that's all we have for today. We'll be back tomorrow with a recap of tonight's game against the Lakers. You can send mailbag questions and ask about advertising by sending an email to lockedonheat@gmail.com. Tweet your questions or comments for our recaps using the hashtag AskLOHeat. Rowan, tell our listeners where they can find you.
Go follow at the crossover on Twitter. That's where I'm at, that's where all of our writers are at. You'll see everything you see about the NBA at the crossover.
Music is courtesy of Mojave Wild. We'll catch you next time.